Jacksonville? Listen local.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole. And thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Because we have a very special presentation for you, a Radio Catskill exclusive. Our own Nia Watson has an in-depth report on how local folks are memorializing the free black community that existed in the mid-1800s in the village of Newburgh. A gravesite from this community was unearthed in Newburgh 16 years ago, just this October. Just a couple months ago, Newburgh unveiled a marker commemorating that burial site and the history behind it. Nia Watson reports on an honorable resting place. That's coming up in a few minutes. But first, we've got some news to get to before that. News from New York, where new polling shows that President-elect Donald Trump is still unpopular here in his home state. Meanwhile, New York's Governor Kathy Hochul is more popular than Trump, but not by much. This new Siena College Research Institute poll finds Trump with a 37% favorability rating in his first post-election poll, and by a 50% to 39% margin, voters said that Trump's return to the White House will be bad for New York. Siena's Steve Greenberg says Trump's underwater polling in the Empire State matches his marks back in January 2017, the first time that he took office.
37% of New Yorkers view Trump favorably, 59% view him unfavorably. Not surprisingly, a huge partisan divide there. 83% of Democrats view Trump unfavorably, 85% of Republicans view him favorably, and independents, not so much. 37% view him favorably, a majority of independents, 53%, view him unfavorably.
With the election behind us, Albany is turning to the new legislative session in January, and believe it or not, it's starting to look also at the looming 2026 race for governor. In New York, a new poll from Siena College Research Institute finds that just a third of voters say they would re-elect Governor Kathy Hochul, and her favorability rating is just 39%. Again, Steve Greenberg with Siena Poll.
57% say they would prefer, quote, someone else, unquote. Among Democrats only, 48% of Democrats say they're prepared to re-elect Hochul. 40% of Democrats would prefer someone else. And when we only ask Democrats, should Hochul be the nominee of your party in 2026 or should she not? 49%, not quite a majority, but 49% said she should be the nominee of the Democrats in 2 years. 32% said of Democrats said she should not.
Governor Hochul has been hoping to turn around her lagging poll numbers. And this week she said affordability will be her focus in the new year. That's one of the issues that helped Republicans in last month's national elections. Here she is speaking in the Bronx yesterday.
Leading up to my State of the State address in January, you're all invited, I'll be outlining even more strategies to make New York more affordable. And once again, I'll keep talking about what we need to do to help New York families thrive and how we're going to stand up for the children of this state.
And as you heard there, Governor Hochul's remarks yesterday kind of serve as a preview of her 2025 State of the State address, which does happen next month. Details include her proposal of $3 billion in tax rebates to 8.5 million New Yorkers and the inflation refund program would send $300 to single taxpayers who earn up to $150,000 a year and $500 for joint filers who make up to $300,000 per year. Hochul's proposal was praised by Democratic Congressman-elect George Latimer, a former state lawmaker and outgoing Westchester County executive.
It's not just political rhetoric. This is a very real check that will be in someone's pocket. The state legislature, where I served, have people that feel the same concerns. I'm sure, Governor, this and the other initiatives that you're going to launch will be well received. And in due time, we'll see the benefit of this thing that's mentioned today in the wallets of the people that we have coming up.
If the legislation is approved by state lawmakers, the one-time payments would begin in the fall. Finally, wrapping up this look at the latest news in New York State, we do have a story that fits in with all of the reporting that we've brought to you the last couple of years about the giant ticking clock in the state And that is, of course, the lofty goals and looming deadlines in the New York Climate Act. A recurring question that we've been digging into with our news partners is, how will the state meet these goals? What changes will be made? Can we reduce our energy use? Can we produce energy more cleanly to meet these goals? Well, to help with those goals, some state officials are exploring the nuclear option. And I mean that literally. A nuclear energy resurgence could be coming to New York. As WSKG's Rebecca Rettelmeyer reports, state officials are eyeing nuclear as a way to create power without contributing to climate change.
New York energy officials announced last month that they are gauging interest from companies who want to develop new nuclear power plants in the state. That could be key to helping the state achieve its climate commitments of transitioning away from burning fossil fuels, says Dietmar Dietering, chair of Nuclear New York.
Nuclear has to be part of this, and now the state is getting it.
Generating nuclear power doesn't create any climate-warming carbon emissions. Still, many environmentalists have concerns about building more of it. That's because nuclear accidents can be extremely harmful, nuclear waste is dangerous, and nuclear is expensive and it takes a long time to build. One nuclear plant built on Long Island in the 70s cost nearly $6 billion, and it never even opened because of concerns that there would be no safe evacuation route if something went wrong. Raya Salter is a member of New York's Climate Action Council, who opposes nuclear energy development.
We have a long and very troubled experience with nuclear in the past. And when you think about it, going into an increasingly climate unstable and geopolitically unstable world, continuing to build these facilities, I think, continues to pose more threat.
Salter and other environmentalists hope to see the state build more solar and wind power. But those renewables only create power when the weather is right, when the sun shines and the wind blows. That means New Yorkers will still need power from other sources.
That's the big topic right now is how do we fill that gap and how big is that gap?
That's Lindsay Anderson, a professor of biological and environmental engineering at Cornell University. Her research has found that even if the state builds as much wind and solar as it plans to, and has batteries to store some of that energy, it still won't be enough. That's why Anderson believes that looking into expanding nuclear power makes sense.
I don't think we should stop investing renewables and just go all nuclear, but I think there is definitely a place for it in this conversation.
Four nuclear reactors along Lake Ontario currently provide 1/5 of the state's electricity. In Ithaca, I'm Rebecca Rettelmeyer for the New York Public News Network.
Thanks to Rebecca for that report, and thanks to all of our colleagues in the New York Public News Network for all of this great reporting.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Yes, this is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Now it's time for our main feature of the night. This is an in-depth story called An Honorable Resting Place. In 2008, a grave site was unearthed during an excavation beneath a school in Newburgh, New York, and the remains that they found date back to the mid-19th century. Today, the site is recognized as the Newburgh Colored Burial Ground, located at what is now the city courthouse. In October this year, an official marker was ceremonially unveiled at the burial ground. The inscription on the marker reads, quote, "The final resting place for the thriving free black community in what was the village of Newburgh." Radio Catskill's Nia Watson spoke with Ramona Burton, director of SUNY Westchester Mount Vernon Extension Center, about her involvement with the Newburgh Colored Burial Ground Committee and spiritual connection to the site. And Watson also met Dr. Andrea Frona, author of The African Burial Ground in New York City, Memory, Spirituality, and Space. And they discussed the history of these burials in the state of New York.
My name is Ramona Burton, born and raised in Newburgh, New York. So I've served on numerous, you know, nonprofit boards, including St. Luke's Hospital Board of Trustees. And I've also served on a lot of school district committees, as well as advisories. And I am also a former two-term elected official of the Newburgh and Lawrence City School District Board of Education. But at the end of the day, they all focus on education, all focus on the disparities of particularly people of color. Everything that I've done, it all has intersected.
Yes, all connects and brings you to where you are today. I would love to talk about the Newburgh Colored Burial Ground Committee. How was the committee formed? When was it formed? And what was the planning like for the marker ceremony that happened in October?
A lot of dates I really don't remember. But what I can tell you is that when I heard about it, I knew there was a connection. somewhere. At the time, I was working for Orange County Community College. And for me, it was an opportunity knowing that this particular situation had come to fruition. We learned later on that the whole excavation had to stop, right? Because of what happened down in New York City, there was a law that was passed that if bones, you know, were found, then, you know, any kind of development had to stop. When I started working for SUNY Orange, we had a space in that building, you know, which is now the courthouse, and we were in the lower level. And I tell you, I'm not one to tell stories. It was the eeriest place ever. And some of the young people would say, Ms. Ramona, it just feels like weird down here. And so what I consider now is we felt the spirits of those bones. I know I'm getting into a spiritual realm because I just am. And so when the mayor at the time said, well, we have to convene a committee, I wanted to be a part of that. Specifically, I wanted to be a part of the education committee because I recognized the importance of, number one, the educational component of it. But number two, when do you have a archaeological team in your community? I was like, oh my goodness, this is a learning opportunity, right? And so that summer, I reached out to some people who were on, you know, the much larger committee. And I said, I want to bring a group of students up there. But the other part of that summer is we worked on a whole project around students' family histories. So there was that connection, right? And then we brought a group of students up there and they had the attention of the lead archaeologists who, you know, just took them through what was going on up there, why, showed them artifacts that were found. I say again, we felt the spirits of, you know, of those bones. A good friend of mine, Dr. Benilda Jones, who's also part of this committee, she was part of the clergy group that would come and pray over the bones. So at some point, the city of Newburgh decided, okay, we're going to stop taking out the bones. As they were coming across bones, they were taking them, you know, out of the space. A decision was made if the team, archaeological team, comes across bones, they will leave them. Leaving them meant a group of clergy people would come in and then pray over them. And then, you know, the archaeological team would move on with whatever they were doing. Yeah, I'm just a curious person by nature. I said, Dr. Jones, when that happens, will you please call me? She said, oh, Ramona, it's early in the morning. I said, I don't care. It's early in the morning. Call me. And one morning I got the call. It was before 6 o'clock in the morning. She says, well, they found some bones. We're going to convene the group and we're going to pray. I went down literally in the ditch where the bones were. And I heard the bones say to me, please don't leave us. You know, my father's Black Baptist minister, so you can call it spiritual, you can call it religious background. I just immediately felt a responsibility to the bones.
Thinking about that, the feeling of being there and that close with the bones and reckoning with it, how did that feel for you?
I don't know how it felt at the time. I just know that I was really quiet afterwards. It was very difficult for me to leave the ditch. And it kept on saying, Ramona, we have to, you know, we have to go. And it was just me. I was just down there by myself at the time. And the clergy were kind of around, you know, after everything was said and done. And what was left of the committee was this celebratory, what would happen afterwards after, because these bones were then taken, they ended up in Newport Senate where they still are. Through the years, I've just kept on staying on top of Dr. Jones about it. Like, We can't forget this. The other impetus for it was one day I ran into Gabrielle. She had talked about how she was working with the city to get the bones reinterred, right? That's, you know, in a nutshell, what the conversation was about. From there, we all met with Allie Church, and we're looking at what, maybe 4 years ago or so, we developed a revised committee of the three of us to begin figuring out the reinterment process. What would that space look like? Collectively, we all got together and we added in Pam Krizek, who was part of the original group as well. And we started planning what would be the next steps. Gabrielle was the one who said, I have the perfect space. And she led us up to Downing Park. We went up to where now, you know, the reinterment will be. And I tell you, we all just kind of sat there and said, this is the perfect space. We started reaching back out to the city and said we found the space. But in the meantime, the whole marker piece came up, like to also give some kind of recognition to the space. And I say recognition because initially the education committee had talked about reinterring the bones up at the courthouse area. And so when that kind of shifted to Downing Park, then it became, well, how do we recognize that it's still a burial ground?
The inscription on the marker, it says the final resting place for the thriving free Black community in what was the village of Newburgh. What do you think it means to have a true final resting place?
You know, part of the committee, there were several recommendations or suggestions on where the bones should be reinterred. I think we all have a right to be placed in a place where we have peace, right? Our bones. Burial is historic across every culture. Giving homage to that is across every culture. But there's also voodoo, right? Bones carry energy, I believe. How do we harness that energy? I think in terms of these bones, we harness the energy by placing them where they should be placed, in a very sacred space where we can now honor them because we took them out of their space. The day of the marker, and so it started raining. And so I'm standing there next to Mayor Harvey. I said, I think it's so ironic that it's starting to rain now. I said, because those bones were revealed because of the rain. And because the earth had been torn apart when it rained, the bones surfaced. And here we are this day, and here it is raining. They were placed very sacredly in the grounds, you know, all facing a certain way. So there was some ritual around their burials. There was still intentionality given to their burials. How do we honor that is we do better. It'll be another formalized educational opportunity for the community to learn more about Indigenous people, about the Black community. Back then, they weren't called the Black community. They were called colored. Colored is what they were at the time, you know, in terms of the census. They were considered colored. So I know there was some talk about, you know, them being called Black, the Black burial ground, or the African-American. No, they were called colored.
I like the word that you used multiple times, honor, and, you know, what it means to really honor this as a resting site. And so with your background, your extensive background in education, or even from a spiritual standpoint, what do you hope people will experience or feel or reflect on when they visit?
When Gabrielle brought us to the space up there, and there's a bench up there currently, all I know is we all sat there. We're like, oh my gosh, this is the most peaceful place. I hope people find peace. Whether anyone believes it's the right place or the wrong place, or, you know, anywhere in between that continuum, I hope people walk away and just feel at peace.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you would like to add about the grounds, about working with the committee, about your work in education surrounding this that I might have forgotten to ask about?
I feel as if the folk that are now part of that process, I trust the process. Gabrielle is part of it. I'll try to be part of it. I think Dr. Jones will try to be a part of it the best we can. We will do the very best within, you know, our abilities to make sure that that resting place is beautiful, that that resting place has an educational component to it. And if we can all understand, it's going to take time. And if we can all understand that this will not be forgotten, it'll work out fine.
So a lot of time and effort went into this, and there's still a lot more work to be done. From the Newburgh Colored Burial Ground Committee, thank you so much, Ramona Burton, for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
As Burton mentioned, and according to New York State Senate legislation, all excavation must cease when human remains are discovered at a digging site. In 1991, the bones of hundreds of enslaved and formerly enslaved individuals were found in New York City during an excavation. The site is the largest known African burial ground in the United States, according to the New York Preservation Archive Project. The site is also recognized as a national monument and memorial, known as the African Burial Ground. This initial discovery spurred research and conversation about the roots of Dutch colonialism in New York, as well as the historical slave ports in Lower Manhattan. I spoke with Dr. Andrea Frohna, professor of African art history at Ohio University, about how this event inspired her research and 2015 book.
My work goes way back to when I was a graduate student at SUNY Binghamton, working on the African Burial Ground in New York City.
Tell me a bit about what that experience was like working on that burial ground and how it kind of pushed you to where you are today.
The topic that I chose, which was to look at how the African Burial Ground in New York City was going to be represented visually in 20th, 21st century contemporary arts. And also, I wanted to analyze the visual culture of how the African Burial Ground was represented in the colonial era. Both of those aspects of the contemporary moment and the colonial era meant that I had to do a lot of digging and that there was not a lot of academic work that had already been written that I could draw upon. That's one of the things that I really learned. And also that really inspired me was that I wanted to write about something that needed writing about, that there wasn't a voice that had been given. So that has really stayed with me and inspired me. How do I get at this material, or how do I bring this knowledge into the open, I guess, in new ways?
I'm glad that you mentioned that it was kind of an underreported field that you were entering, and so you had to do a lot of digging. Your book specifically talks about New York City, but can you tell a bit about some of the history that you found out while you were doing this digging and this research?
Yeah, so my book is called The African Burial Ground in New York City, Memory, Spirituality, and Space, and all the excavation had already occurred when I started doing my research in 1996. But journalism was an extremely important component to the research because it was really the journalists who started coming down to the site in Lower Manhattan and reporting on the simultaneous excavation of the remains while the office building at 290 Broadway was being built. And then, one of the really important things for concerned citizens who were trying to follow the African Burial Ground was, what were the remains? What were the artifacts? What were the objects that were a part of the burials? How were the people buried? So I do spend a big long chapter writing about that. So another thing that I learned about with my research was, what were the politics that were going on in New York City that made it possible for the African Burial Ground to finally be represented and to be honored and to be commemorated? And so I was very interested in how, when the attempt was made to put those checks and balances in place, they really could work at a civic level. It spread to a national level as well, but you could really start to see things clicking and falling into place.
Can you share a bit more about the origins of African burial grounds, the connection to colonialism? I know there's a lot of colonialism history in New York, just given its place geographically in the United States. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I think the African Burial Ground in New York City has really forced an opening up of the understanding of U.S. history and of African American history. When we study history in elementary school, in middle school, in high school, we don't really learn about slavery beyond the South or beyond the Deep South. And there is a history of slavery in New York State. There's a history of slavery all along the eastern ports of Boston and Providence and in Rhode Island. And in fact, in the 1800s, New York City had the second largest population of enslaved people after the state of South Carolina. Another connection that I could talk about of the African Burial Ground in relation to colonialism is that the cartography is extremely interesting because the mapping of this space that's being colonized, that's being settled, becomes evident in the maps where people of European and European American descent want to visualize and claim the space that they're moving into. And so you see these maps that start to reoccur of
of New York and of Manhattan. And I was really interested in which cartographers included the African burial ground, which at that time was called the Negroes Burying Ground. And then I also wanted to question why other map makers left that cemetery off of that colonial record. So I do spend a chapter kind of going through those questions. And the other interesting thing about maps is that we take them as an objective truth, and there's so much subjectivity that comes into what kind of symbols go on the map. Which cemeteries do you acknowledge the existence of, and which ones do you not pay attention to? Which churches get included? Those kinds of questions.
I think that's just, in a larger context, really intriguing, you know, thinking about how, like the Newburgh burial, we won't really find out about these until years and years later. There's another part of your book I really wanted to ask about, and that's your section on spirituality. Can you talk a bit about spirituality and this connection in African burials?
Yes. So a major point to bear in mind and to recognize is that almost half of the burials in the African burial ground in New York City are people who were brought directly from the African continent or from the Caribbean. The British were bringing enslaved Africans from Africa to the Caribbean and then to New York. But in either case, you have a population of first generation Africans and people who came through the Caribbean. At the same time, you have people being born in New York City who are the first generation of what will become the African diaspora or the first generation of African Americans in New York City. So you have both of those populations buried in a cemetery that holds 15,000 to 20,000 people, we believe. So really a large communal cemetery, 6 to 7 city blocks in size. When I was attending demonstrations and open houses and discussions about commemorating the site, African spirituality came up a lot, honoring the ancestors, pouring libations, and incorporating aspects of African art related to spirituality. And so that's why I spent time exploring the components of African spirituality that play into recognizing the cemetery and the spirituality that was engaged and involved in honoring the ancestors.
You know, you just mentioned this word honor. And so I wanted to ask, what are your thoughts on the idea of an honorable resting place and what that means?
So I think the idea of an honorable resting place really relates to listening to community voices and listening to the needs of people who are engaged with that cemetery site. Honoring also can have a direct conflict with other needs of a space, especially if it's urban, especially if it has a high real estate value, right? So there are these negotiations of capital versus sacred space versus racism and the history of racism that has occurred before and the attempt to reckon with that racism in the contemporary moment as well. So honoring the dead becomes complicated, especially when people need to leave offerings or need to communicate with the dead. So these are all kinds of colliding consequences that occur when you start to honor the dead.
I didn't even think about it like that, about, you know, what that would look like in, let's say, an urban space or maybe a more rural or a suburban space and the aesthetics of it. I think that's just a really interesting point that you raise. Is there anything else you'd like to add about this, about your research, about your book that I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, I think it's always a congratulatory moment when a town or a city comes face to face with its history. And so, you know, it's really exciting what Newburgh is doing. And I know it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy, but it's also going to be very rewarding and it's going to educate and inspire so many people in the future as well.
Thank you so much, Andrea Frohna, professor and author of The African Burial Ground in New York City, for joining us today.
Thank you.
In Liberty, I'm Nia Watson for Radio Catskill.
Thank you so much, Nia Watson, for that great report. And a big thanks to Nia for all the work that you've done for us here. That's it for the local edition. I've been your host, Jason Dole. I'll be back tomorrow night. We'll do it all over again. But for now, you want to stay with us because coming up next, it's The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Radio Catskill. Listen local.